As it turns out, the same two candidates do run against each other in consecutive elections all the time. Indeed, in nearly 1,000 U.S. congressional races since 1972. And what do the numbers have to say about such cases? Here's the surprise. The amount of money spent by the candidates hardly matters at all. A winning candidate can cut his spending in half and lose only 1% of the vote. Meanwhile, a losing candidate who doubles his spending can expect to shift the vote in his favor by only that same 1%. What really matters for a political candidate is not how much you spend. What really matters is who you are. The same could be said, and will be said, in Chapter 5 of this book about parents. Some politicians are inherently attractive to voters, and others simply aren't, and no amount of money can do much about it. Messrs. Dean, Forbes, Huffington, and Golisano already know this, of course. And what about the other half of the election truism, that the amount of money spent on campaign finance is obscenely huge? In a typical election period that includes campaigns for the presidency, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, about $1 billion is spent per year, which sounds like a lot of money, unless you care to measure it against something seemingly less important than Democratic elections. It is the same amount, for instance, that Americans spend every year on chewing gum. This isn't a book about the cost of chewing gum versus campaign spending per se, or about disingenuous real estate agents, or the impact of legalized abortion on crime. It will certainly address these scenarios and dozens more, from the art of parenting to the mechanics of cheating, from the inner workings of the Ku Klux Klan to racial discrimination on The Weakest Link. What this is about is stripping a layer or two from the surface of modern life and seeing what is happening underneath. We will ask a lot of questions, some frivolous and some about life and death issues. The answers may often seem odd, but after the fact also rather obvious. We will seek out these answers in the data, whether those data come in the form of school children's test scores, or New York City's crime statistics, or a crack dealer's financial records. Often, we will take advantage of data that were incidentally left behind, like an airplane's sharp contrail in a high sky. It is well and good to opine or theorize about a subject, as humankind is wont to do, but when moral posturing is replaced by an honest assessment of the data, most subjects actually become even more compelling. Morality, it could be argued, represents the way that people would like the world to work, whereas economics represents how it actually does work. Economics is, above all, a science of measurement. It comprises an extraordinarily powerful and flexible set of tools that can reliably assess a thicket of information to determine the effect of any one factor, or even the whole effect. That's what the economy is, after all, a thicket of information about jobs and real estate and banking and investment. But the tools of economics can be just as easily applied to subjects that are more, well, more interesting. This recording, then, represents a very specific worldview based on a few fundamental ideas. 1. Incentives are the cornerstone of modern life, and understanding them, or often ferreting them out, is the key to solving just about any riddle, from violent crime to sports cheating to online dating. 2. The conventional wisdom is often wrong. Crime didn't keep soaring in the 1990s. Money alone doesn't win elections. And, surprise, drinking 8 glasses of water a day has never actually been shown to do a thing for your health. Conventional wisdom is often shoddily formed and devilishly difficult to overturn, but it can be done. 3. Dramatic effects often have distant, even subtle, causes. The answer to a given riddle is not always right in front of you. Norma McCorvey had a far greater impact on crime than did the combined forces of gun control, a strong economy, and innovative police strategies. So did, as we shall see, a man named Oscar Daniil Blandon, a.k.a. the Johnny Appleseed of crack. 4. Experts, from criminologists to real estate agents, use their informational advantage to serve their own agenda. However, they can be beat at their own game. And in the face of the internet, their informational advantage is shrinking every day, as evidenced by, among other things, the falling price of coffins and life insurance premiums. 5. Knowing what to measure and how to measure it makes a complicated world much less so. If you learn to look at data in the right way, you can explain riddles that otherwise might have seemed impossible, because there is nothing like the sheer power of numbers to scrub away layers of confusion and contradiction. So our aim here is to explore the hidden side of everything. This may occasionally be a frustrating exercise. It may sometimes feel as if we are peering at the world through a straw, or even staring into a funhouse mirror. But the idea is to look at many different scenarios and examine them in a way that have rarely been examined. In some regards, this is a strange concept for a book. Most books put forth a single theme, crisply expressed in a sentence or two, and then tell the entire story of that theme, the history of salt, the fragility of democracy, the use and misuse of punctuation. This one boasts no such unifying theme. We did consider, for about 6 minutes, writing a book that would revolve around a single theme, the theory and practice of applied microeconomics, anyone? But opted instead for a sort of treasure hunt approach. Yes, this approach employs the best analytical tools that economics can offer, but it also allows us to follow whatever freakish curiosities may occur to us. Thus, our invented field of study, freakonomics. The sort of stories we are going to tell are not often covered in Econ 101, but that may not be true forever. Since the science of economics is primarily a set of tools as opposed to a subject matter, then no subject, however offbeat, should be beyond its reach. It is worth remembering that Adam Smith, the founder of classical economics, was first and foremost a philosopher. He strove to be a moralist, and in so doing, became an economist. When he published The Theory of Moral Sentiments in 1759, modern capitalism was just getting underway. Smith was entranced by the sweeping changes wrought by this new force, but it wasn't only the numbers that interested him. It was the human effect, the fact that economic forces were vastly changing the way a person thought and behaved in a given situation. What might lead one person to cheat or steal while another didn't? How would one person's seemingly innocuous choice, good or bad, affect a great number of people down the line? In Smith's era, cause and effect had begun to wildly accelerate. Incentives were magnified tenfold. The gravity and shock of these changes were as overwhelming to the citizens of his time as the gravity and shock of modern life seem to us today. Smith's true subject was the friction between individual desire and societal norms. The economic historian Robert Heilbronner, writing in The Worldly Philosophers, wondered how Smith was able to separate the doings of man, a creature of self-interest, from the greater moral plane in which man operated. Heilbronner wrote, "Smith held that the answer lay in our ability to put ourselves in the position of a third person, an impartial observer, and in this way to form a notion of the objective merits of a case." Consider yourself, then, in the company of a third person, or, if you will, a pair of third people, eager to explore the objective merits of interesting cases. These explorations generally begin with the asking of a simple, unasked question, such as, what do school teachers and sumo wrestlers have in common? I'd like to put together a set of tools that let us catch terrorists, Levitt said. I don't necessarily know yet how I'd go about it, but given the right data, I have little doubt that I could figure out the answer. It might seem absurd for an economist to dream of catching terrorists, just as it must have seemed absurd if you were a Chicago school teacher, called into an office and told that the algorithms designed by that skinny man with thick glasses had determined that you are a cheater, and that you are being fired. Stephen Levitt may not fully believe in himself, but he does believe in this. Teachers and criminals and real estate agents may lie, and politicians and even CIA analysts, but numbers don't. From the New York Times Magazine.